Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How you doing?
I'm good.
So, Lang.next 2012. What's going on?
What's going on? Well, we're sitting here, you know, kind of, you know, grazing on some calories here. I don't know.
All right, and who are we with, man?
Well, who are we with? Donna.
Gilad.
And Luke.
Luke Hoban. All of you have been on Channel 9 before.
So now, yeah, this is like an interesting kind of, you know, combination here, because, you know, we have like, you know, the JavaScript standards committee
and the kind of
and Dart. So yeah. That's the great thing about Lang.net, that, you know, language geeks, you know, are always kind of, you know,
they're
happy when they can
talk
about languages. They're everywhere.
It's really nice. There's not enough of these things. I mean, there's Splash and Oopsla and that kind of stuff, but this is more practitioner, implementer.
Well, at Oopsla, you have to kind of, you know, you have to do all these kind of Greek symbols and horizontal lines.
Not so much at Oopsla, and Popple.
That is true, yes. Popple,
it's required, Greek symbols are.
Yes, but here it's like really, you know, like, there's also a lot of people that are just interested in languages that not necessarily kind of, you know, build languages and so on. So
excellent.
Anyway, so Luke, I was this morning I was doing JavaScript, you know. Eric does JavaScript. Yeah. So I even learned something about like ECMAScript 5, you know, it's like this new object thing or object.create or what is it? Yeah, can you explain that?
Yeah,
is that old?
No.
Oh,
no,
I just discovered that. It's like a new old.
No. I'm saying there's a whole set of them on object, sort of a set of reflective capabilities.
Yes.
That are generally. Generally very handy tools. Several of them, like object.create, were actually things that there were libraries out there, like Doug Crockford had one that he was sort of advocating people use, that was very similar to what object.create became. But it's just basically the ability to create an object that's born with a certain object as its prototype, and then you can provide an object that contains all of the fields of the object. And I think it's a handy sort of library level function. In practice, people often have been hiding it behind some other factory. So, like a lot of the, you know, more directly user-facing class-based patterns might use that behind the scenes to set up the classes. But object.create by itself is sort of a primitive for creating an object with a prototype.
But now maybe like I sound like a JavaScript heretic, but I mean, like what I always find weird when I do JavaScript is that I have to write code to do declarations. I just want to declare a class, but now I have to kind of write kind of statements to kind of, you know, write what.
Right.
So is that a good thing? Am I crazy, or is the JavaScript way the
I know that's crazy, but
you know, in this particular kind of context, right?
No, I think you're not crazy.
So why don't you have like a regular kind of, you know, class system in there with interfaces and classes like Dart?
Yes. As you may have seen, there's been a lot of work on this problem over many, many, many years in the JavaScript world.
And every time, you know, you have to pick which one. Do I use this convention, that convention?
Well, I think it's one of the fundamental problems that in the JavaScript community already today, there are many, many patterns being used.
Yes.
And there's both different patterns for the actual object models you create, and there's different models even for each of those object models. There's different choices for how you actually sort of aesthetically write that out to and whether you use some library or some built-in prototype smashing imperative code. And so I think it's traditionally been hard in the standards process to sort of pick one and say, this is going to be the thing that everyone's going to go and use, because inevitably it doesn't support every different thing out there. And so I think that's been one of the forces that's, you know, slowed down the ability to have a class model, have a consensus. But you know, a lot of progress has been made on that. There are, you know, classes are still part of the approved set of sort of features for ECMAScript 6, and so they're being worked on as something that would be in the next version of the ECMAScript standard. I think they're the feature in there that's probably at the most risk, because there's still been a lot of sort of different viewpoints on it. But there continues to be work to try and get a class model. And I completely agree, and I think, you know, JavaScript developers generally agree that having a sort of declarative way of describing a class is just a really useful tool for avoiding a lot of the time spent just sitting there thinking, I'm wanting to write this class, and instead of writing the class, sitting there thinking about how do I decompose this basic notion I have in my head into a bunch of imperative statements that create that object model.
And isn't it like in practice already kind of, you're like, if you're using a certain library that you're kind of tied into a certain model, and the same for namespaces, right, or packages, you know, you use npm, you know, it has to be kind of, you know, of this shape.
Well, I mean, each one of these libraries, a lot of these libraries have come up with a way of sort of an abstraction for this, right? And like, Dojo has a way of defining, you know, the various components of your sort of object model. And I think there's many of these, and the big problem is that these aren't compatible between them. And so when
so how does that work? How do you interrupt? Right, I have like a jQuery thing that I want to, you know, use that in a Dojo library. How is that possible? Or
I mean, there's always sort of ways to use them. I mean, no matter which libraries you use and what syntax you use to write these, they're ultimately building up reasonably similar object models in some way. They're using a prototype chain to do class methods, and they're wiring up inheritance through the prototype chain or something like that. And there's only a couple of sort of standard patterns for that. And so generally, these things are to some degree interoperable, but almost never fully interoperable. Mm-hmm. And there's normally features that each library has that are unique to it that it has hooked up through some custom way. And so I think that's the place where a declarative class model can be a big win, is just having a unifying force that all libraries can sort of start to converge on better.
So to kind of switch the conversation like a little bit, like, you know, you work on F-sharp type providers, right?
That's right.
And I think that's very similar to what Gilad has been kind of, you know, pimping for a long time, which is like, you know, the layered type
system. Oh, right, the pluggable type system.
Yes, yes. Right. So is Gilad right yet again?
I envy
the guy, right? Every time the guy is like right,
how
is that possible? How can somebody be so right so often?
That is a good point. So I think that the idea of pluggable type systems does make a lot of sense. But I don't know if type providers quite fit that model, because type providers basically let you extend the compiler. But then from that point on, it's using the regular F-sharp type system. So you don't add any additional new kinds of type checking. You actually create new code that has to get type checked and new types that you can then use to type check. Whereas I believe with the pluggable type system, the idea was that types are completely optional in the most extreme form. And then you can, you know, start checking certain properties.
Well, essentially, you can introduce a checker or a type system that is designed to deal with certain properties and check it. And because, in fact, it's completely optional and is not impinging on what your program actually does and execution-wise, these things won't interfere with each other.
Right.
So you can introduce another one to check something else.
Right.
And you can do that safely because they're not banging on each other in
right,
any
right,
sense.
Right.
But isn't that the same with the type providers? Because they are erased, right? It's like only a compile time thing
so
where you dot into the thing. And
they're not necessarily erased. That you can write them so that they're erased. So basically, you know, it looks like you're creating new types, but you're actually just calling functions that,
yes,
you know,
yes, yeah.
turn things, erase things. But you're not doing any additional type checking. So you're not saying, now I want to check this other property. Am I using like this database properly? It's actually, the way you check that is by generating a schema from the database and then importing it into your program. Whereas with Gilad's model, you would actually say, oh, now I want to check to make sure that, you know, I'm doing multi-threading properly and I have a protocol for that, and there's, say, maybe annotations, and then you would have a kind of an analysis that goes over that. Typically, those are called, you know, some static analysis pass rather than type checking, but they're really all the same kind of thing.
But if you're opening up the compiler to do like
intelligence, yes.
Could you kind of, is that something that, you know, you're thinking of? Because why shouldn't I be able to kind of add my own type rules, you know, instead of just my intelligence rules?
I see. Well, that's not the direction that type providers are currently going. Like you don't extend the type system, you don't add new type rules, but you just give new types that then fit into the same hierarchy. The nice thing about it is that then it makes it much easier to write the extension, right? Because it's a very limited case, so you don't have to do all of the things that you'd have to do, like, you know, a flow analysis or some kind of lattice function or things like that.
So one of the things that, you know, that, I mean, I'm hooked on it, right? You know, it's like, I as I always say, I paid, like, you know, I happily paid $25 to Joe Albahari for, you know, like, you know, to get the dot to work in LinkPad. Because, you know, it's like, I'm hooked on the dot. If I hit the dot, I want to see something. On the other hand, I'm not sure if that's the right way to navigate your objects, you know, or your type system, because, like, for example, in type providers, often you have like a very long list, and so are there other ways, like, you know, more, I don't know, different ways to browse around in your code and in your libraries?
Yeah. So certainly the notion of code completion based on types has become very popular, but there are other things that you can do. Which is, for example, if you can look at your code with reference to some execution state. So this is relatively easy to do when you're in a debugger, for example, mm-hmm. when you actually have some state. then you can find out things that the types won't tell you, like what's the value in this object? What is the actual concrete type in this object that may very well be a subtype of something else? Yeah. And what can I get from that information? So there's a kind of a different kind of completion you can imagine seeing happen, provided that you don't have just dead code anymore, but you actually have something live. So tying these things to, say, a test suite and saying, okay, I can get some exemplar object that is an instance of the class I'm looking at, and then I'll actually be able to have more dynamic information about this and help. That'll help navigate, making basically dealing with the code when it's live, when it's running.
Yeah, because that's
an area that hasn't been
because
really
that's also interesting, because usually the debuggers, you can set a breakpoint, but then you have to go to the immediate window or something else to kind of type some expressions. But I want to kind of
go right in my code and
hit there. Yes.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things that we do a lot in the Visual Studio, we have JavaScript language server support, and one of the really interesting things that we've been doing there is actually using, just to provide completion, not to provide capabilities beyond completion and associated features, but actually using the running the program and trying to drive execution towards where the caret is. I'm doing a whole bunch of sort of rewriting of your code to try and make loops and branches and things go towards the point in your code and tracking those live values, but then using those, sort of throwing away a bunch of the information we've gathered and just reporting back to the user, here's what your completion list looks at that point. But it's actually going to be the completion list based on the true runtime values that made it to that point along that execution path. And this kind of thing's never going to be as 100% reliable as sitting on top of type information, but it is amazing how rich it can already be.
Well, it's both less and more reliable, because on the one hand, this is information from some particular run, which might not be valid. On the other hand, it's very much like the dynamic optimization problem, that you actually have more information than you'll ever have static analysis time, because you really that this is some exact subclass of something. Yep. There's various advantages to this sort of thing. And ideally, it's a lot easier to work with the static information, so it's good to have. It makes it easier to get nice tools, but we've sort of neglected that, this kind of area of utilizing dynamic information.
Yes, and why is that? Because there's so much information that gets generated as your program runs, right, that we could log and then kind of use to kind of develop. And we're crawling the web and to kind of answer questions, whereas our programs run and we're kind of just throwing away all the kind of signals that they produce. Why is that?
I think it's hard, right? It's a harder problem.
Is it harder than crawling the web?
No, I mean harder than the problems we're solving as tools builders. And I think there are big opportunities there to continue to leverage that information. We have tons of tools now that are doing profiling runs and trying to capture information from those, and unit test runs and that kind of thing. And so we do have a lot of this data. It's correlating that back, and the problems that Gilad mentioned, the fact that these runs might not be, they might not be characteristic of normal runs, and so you might get data that confuses developers. I think we still haven't figured out how to best surface that kind of information in the traditional tools that developers are used to, but I think it's a big opportunity.
Yes, because I always feel that it's kind of so separate, right? You're doing profiling, and it's like, a separate thing that's kind of, it's like very hard to tie it back to, your actual live program. So let's kind of go back to kind of, like the languages that we kind of are working on. So you work on F#.
That's right.
And then you work on JavaScript, you work on Dart. So each of them has kind of, their kind of ways to deal with functions or anonymous functions. So can you explain in Dart why kind of you use the kind of the syntax for for
the arrow kind of thing?
The fat arrow, yes.
So there are several.
There's several reasons
for that. One is simply, it's a syntactic shorthand that people are lazy. They hate typing in all forms.
Yes, I 100% agree with that.
And the other thing is that We might have other uses for this in the future, right? It is less tied. We tried to keep the original ones relatively compatible with what JavaScript functions look like in some sense. That's as the project has evolved, that's become a little less critical. It started up with a mentality that said we'd like to port JavaScript code unchanged, and we still like to make it easy to port that, but we've found that it's more important to to design things right and give a little on that compatibility. And this is a sort of different construct, and so it might give us a little leeway in the future.
And so then I also saw that now in JavaScript they're proposing the fat arrow, but then it suddenly has different semantics than just like a rewrite into that. To me, I mean, I think my brain will explode because you know it's not syntactic sugar anymore. It now suddenly has semantics. So can you explain what the reasoning is behind that?
Well, it's been one of the long debates in this has been whether just a pure syntactic shorthand is worth it. I mean, if it's just going to be saving you six characters,
is that function, a curly open, return?
Well, it's only
it's
like, you know,
it's
like, yeah.
It's at least eight.
It's actually only six. It's actually only at least six because you have to also put the arrow instead of the word function. But anyway. There's been a lot of debate on this.
Okay, you obviously kept count.
Yes. but I think, you know, there is a legitimate argument certainly for having a version that is just a, you know, just exactly the same construct. The issue is that in JavaScript, you know, functions are already a very confusing topic, especially this binding of functions.
I love it. Like whenever somebody says to me, you know, I understand JavaScript, and I say, okay, can you explain to me what this does in JavaScript? Yes.
And it is a very confusing topic.
Question,
one of the largest sources of one of the largest sources of just sort of basic misunderstandings and errors in code is references to this from within callbacks, effectively.
Yes.
Which, you know, silently you're getting a dynamic this into your function. And so that's something that's unexpected to many people coming into JavaScript and is a source of a lot of problems in a language where functions are heavily used for callback-based programming and that sort of thing. So the idea is that lambdas aim to both provide a shorter syntax, but also for the use cases where a inline function is the appropriate thing to do, that they try to solve that this problem by giving you sort of the lexical this from the outer scope. So that you can then, if you're using lambdas, you don't really have to think about this problem. So in 5-7 years, whenever it is that sort of lambdas might be broadly used, that you wouldn't have to have as much of a sort of, you wouldn't need to know about this problem as much as you do now.
So the thing is, like in C sharp, you know, there's like, you know, also like, you know, I think five ways to define a delegate. But what I find myself often do, I start with a kind of a fat arrow, but then, you know, I want to add some more statements, so I turn it into kind of, you know, a different form. And
well,
so
the fat arrow in C sharp is a good example here because it does, it is very flexible. You can, you know, you can have a statement body or you can have an expression.
Yes.
And the JavaScript arrow also, the one that was gained consensus at the TC39 meeting last week, does also have that behavior that it can have a statement block body or it can have an expression body. So it is very flexible in terms of the percentage of functions, the existing functions today that could be turned into lambdas or fat arrows.
Yeah.
But the one different aspect of it is this binding of this. And I think, you know, there was some good analysis that was done by, I'm not going to remember the name, but someone who was contributing on the ECMAScript discussions alias who went and surveyed a whole bunch of code bases and saw that the percentage of cases that both, you know, if you had this feature plus if you had, you know, kind of method binding where like another feature in ECMAScript 6 is the ability to declare methods and object literals. And the combination of those would basically take care of, I think it was 93% of all functions could be taken care of through one of those. And so any other sort of mix and match of the combinations would not serve as much of the use cases. And so that was good data to have to kind of show that there was value in taking that particular combination of the options.
Hey, and Donna, so the interesting thing is that a lot of the kind of, you know, OO languages are adding like closures, like in C sharp or in JavaScript, which, you know, it's kind of in JavaScript maybe the function is like, you know, the object. But what I like about F sharp is that they do have like object expressions, which is the thing that I always missed from Java, actually, anonymous inner classes. So because you not only want to do closures for functions, but you also often, when you want to create an interface, you want to create an anonymous interface. So can you explain a little bit how these object expressions work in F sharp?
So the way it is that you don't have to give a name to the object, you just put it in the definition. I think it's, is it curly brace is the syntax for it? And I guess I don't use it that often.
I'm writing
very functional code, I think, and not using object expressions. But the nice thing
like
is that...
But like in .NET, you always have to pass iComparable, iEquatable, whatever.
Right, right. So it automatically is creating, you know, the equality function, the hash code. It's automatically making everything immutable. It's basically setting up a lot of the stuff for you. So if you have, you know, a case where you want to return multiple values from a function, or say you just want to group something together because it makes more sense that way, and pass it off somewhere else, it just is much more compact and concise than having to declare something ahead of time, even if you're only going to use it once. So I think that's one of the benefits there.
And so, and Gilad, so in Java, the weird thing with anonymous inner classes is that, you know...
A weird thing,
I would say, amongst the weird things that they have to capture final kind of variables.
Right, so the motivation for that, John Rose is here somewhere, well,
yes,
not here,
grab
but
him
he,
at some point.
It's his fault, because, well, or he brought up the motivation for this was multi-threading. Right, so the idea that you know, these things could be mutated, whatever, in a language that was heavily promoting multi-threading seemed scary and problematic. And so the idea was that by ensuring that these things weren't proper closures, in fact, but only were limited to these things that weren't going to vary, you kind of got away from that particular problem. Now,
but
that's not a trade-off that I necessarily
support. Yeah, but if you have like an array there or something, it's still mutable, right?
Exactly. It just looks final.
In fact, there's a well-known implementation trick for closures where you actually put the variables
That's my favorite trick.
So it's just one of those unfortunate things about anonymous classes, and you know, I don't actually miss them.
No, and so in Dart, do you have like some ways
to
do anonymous kind
of literals?
No,
we don't have object literals, and anonymous
classes
were basically a weird form of object literal. We might add them eventually. We don't miss them very much. We have classes, and we're quite happy with it. Interestingly, in Newspeak, I had intended to add object literals, and it hasn't happened yet because really it's not particularly pressing. You don't actually need it all that often, given all the other mechanisms you have. It might be occasionally nice to have, but it's much less critical than...
Yeah, but I think, again, this comes back to kind of a library design, right? Because like in .NET, it's kind of, you know, maybe it's a little bit where you can see the kind of lava flow from earlier times, where some of the older interfaces kind of, you know, or methods, they require an interface that just has like one method where you could say, you know, it's like, it would be easy to kind of, you know, pass in a delegate. But now, you know, you have to create... So do you have like any libraries in Dart where, you know, where you haven't that take an interface that would be easy to kind of cook up on the fly or not?
I don't know that we have. Again, this is still very much in flux. The libraries are very young and probably subject to a lot of change. Another thing is if you think in terms of closures from day one, you tend not to necessarily have that sort of thing, because if it's really just the one thing, you just want a function
for a certain time.
No runnable, right?
Yes, yeah.
Right. So, for example, in Smalltalk, you don't get one method classes, right? You just don't, because you can pass in the necessary closure. And so it's an artifact of a system like Java where obviously you can pass functions around, but you have to attach them to an object. That's the only way to get it. And so that's how all that boilerplate materializes. It's a symptom of a deeper mistake.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I really, really like about Dart is the fact that it has, like, you know, default implementations for interfaces. So can you explain, you know, why that's useful, or maybe, you know, if I'm kind of, you know, maybe mistaken that they're so cool, but...
So the idea is basically is that you can associate with an interface a class that was going to be the default implementation. And so you can write code that says, you know, new comparable or whatever. Well, we probably won't have comparable because there's no need for it anymore. Yeah. That's a throwback to, you know, computed GoTo. But this is the name of an interface that comes to mind, right?
From the olden days.
From the pre-olden days.
From the lizard brain.
Yeah, exactly, yes. The amygdala likes these things. Basically... You basically mention the name of the interface, but say new, and it will produce an instance of whatever the default class is, which means that you can write your code completely without reference to a concrete implementation class, which is a nice thing. You can then change what that implementation class is at the interface declaration, and it'll all get taken care of. So it's very attractive in that sense that it reduces the coupling between things without making people have to think too explicitly about, you know, dependency injection or parameterization or anything that might, you know, that would solve this perhaps more thoroughly, but just in a very natural way. So they don't make that mistake. They just, you know, most of the library actually has this form where the public APIs are interfaces.
Yes.
We literally don't put out the actual implementation classes. And so you have to say new list or new map or whatever. And you're not saying what implementation necessarily you're getting.
And it keeps you from having to, ending up writing concrete classes, which is very easy to do in languages like Java, where, you know, you might say linked list everywhere. You really meant to say list.
Well, in Java, it's extraordinarily hard to avoid being tied up by these things.
Technically, you only need it when you instantiate an object, though, the actual class name.
That's true. The thing is, occasionally you do instantiate objects.
But I mean, all your variable declarations, all your method parameters.
That's true. You don't need them on all those.
But see lots of code that does it anyway.
Right.
But isn't that an artifact of the fact that, you know, you have to specify the type? Because in JavaScript, you know, it's duck typing, right? It's like, you know, you just, you know, if you pass in anything that has the right methods or properties, then it will work.
I mean, I think it's one of the interesting things about the Java C sharp kind of style approach to, you know, to classes, obviously, is that they're this nice convenience for giving you both a type and a concrete implementation of that.
Yes.
If you want to do interface-based programming, you actually have to double your work.
Yes.
Because then you've got to go and write a separate interface and
yep.
a class.
And it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, exactly.
It never
right.
had to be
yeah.
that way. Because, in fact, if you build your type system around the notion of interfaces, the type that the class induces should not be an implementation
yep,
type.
Exactly.
It should be an interface that consists of the public members of that thing so that you don't have to duplicate the hierarchy.
Yep. Right. That was COM. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
or
I was going to mention
kind of,
that when you were describing this feature. I was like,
that's
not like COM.
Yes. Well, it was also in the strong talk type
yep.
system.
Right, exactly. I was just about to say,
yeah.
I know you're not a fan of structural type systems, but that's exactly what that gives you.
But you don't have to be structural to do that.
Right.
It can be completely nominal. You can still achieve that. The point is, you have to commit to using interfaces, right? You say you can't actually rely on a particular implementation type in that way. And the Dart type system is that way, too. If you choose to use the name of a class as a type, it still means an interface. It doesn't mean anything about a particular implementation.
So I know that you're passionate about structural versus nominal types, but can you explain why nominal types are so popular with compiler writers and language designers, and why structural types are maybe more popular with kind of, you know, developers?
Well, I don't know if it's fair to say that structural types are more popular with developers. I think developers like duck types, which aren't really types, they just make, you know, you kind of group a set of methods that you call together, and you can call that a type. The problem with that is that in any given run, you might have a different set of methods that you call. So really, you're not saying that you know, your object is a duck. You're just saying that during this run, you happen to call like the quack and the walk method or something like that. But that the point there, though, is that that's really interesting is that when some people say dynamically typed languages don't tie your hands the way statically typed ones do. And this is one key reason. And that's that in a statically typed nominal type system, you have to declare your type before you use it, number one. And number two, you have to say that a class implements a given interface. You can't say when you define the class. So you can't define the interface
mm-hmm.
later and
yep.
the class later or something like that. Or as you were saying, if you have legacy code that requires an interface and your class actually does implement it, it just, you know, maybe you know, does it has more methods or just doesn't name that interface, there isn't any easy way to retrofit. So you end up having to create proxies or do conversions. And Scala, they added implicit conversion. Well, one of the main uses of implicit conversions is to deal with those. Whereas with structural types, you actually just get a type that's, you know, all the public members of the class. And any type that has all of those members is equivalent to it. And so you automatically get kind of 2 to the n different super types. So if you have 10 methods, you know, you get 2 to the n of the subset, basically. So if there's different combinations of those methods that are interesting, you don't have to define them in advance. So you don't have to know that, oh, it's interesting to have a collection that you can add and remove, but not clear, maybe. That's a silly one. You can add and remove, but not change an individual element. But maybe it's also interesting to have something where you can remove, but not read. So maybe you can read, but not remove. And there's actually different combinations. You can imagine a log file that you can write to but maybe you can't modify existing entries.
Or a kind of, you know, a conference paper that you can only write but never read.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yes, there's things like that where maybe other people are putting something into that
conference database. For those papers.
Yes. So, you know, I previously, in my previous life, I did a kind of empirical study of to look at methods that were called, and there's actually interesting patterns that come up in Java programs, like what I was just saying, where you can write to an object. The object actually only ever ended up, the method only ever ended up writing to the object, never reading it, and it turns out it was like something like a log extraction. So that's the advantage. So the reason that it's not in most languages, I think, is partly performance, because if your language is structurally typed, you have to do some clever things to make sure that method dispatch is efficient. And it's much easier to just have your vtable ahead of time, and you know.
And what about like type-based overloading or recursive types? Because how do you know? Doesn't it get like super complicated to decide whether two types are structurally equivalent? And you know, what does overloading mean when you have structural?
Oh
types?
Well, okay. So I personally don't believe in overloading. So that's that solves that right there.
Okay.
Except for a number of arguments.
Okay.
I think overloading on two types that could possibly be equivalent doesn't make any sense.
Yes.
So that's why in Java and C Sharp you could have a method that takes an object and one that takes a string, and depending on whether or not you put a cast or a clone or something like that, your method call changes. So the thing
that's
about
by the way also the most fascinating parts of the language specs have to do with kind of type-based
all
overloading.
Those, questions about that on forums. The recursive types can get tricky, but you could kind of get around that a little bit by having type of names and type of abbreviations, and maybe making it kind of look nominal but actually be structural. And I guess there's different ways you can make type equality.
But like
you
in
Haskell, simple.
Yeah, but in Haskell then you have like both nominal and structural types, and then there's type synonyms and data and stuff. Like,
that's the other reason not to do structural types, is that it's actually much simpler to say, well, this is what a foo is, it's exactly this thing here. So maybe the right thing is interfaces that you can implement after the fact.
I'm sorry. So one more point about structural types is, I don't know if you've hit this, but error reporting.
Oh yes, that's very,
very
tricky.
Very difficult with structural typing,
right?
Because the nominal types give you some sort of handle on programmer intent.
Exactly.
Yes.
And the structural types don't, and where you report the error, it can be very far away from where the actual sort of human error was.
Right.
Where the intention was violated.
Where basically you meant for a class to implement some type, but you didn't have to say it, so you didn't.
Right.
And then
you find the type checker finds the inconsistency somewhere entirely different,
exactly.
And you can start chasing, well, why was that? And after 20 steps, you might hit the thing.
Well, you might be able to partly solve that problem by having a discipline where you don't require type abbreviations, but you, it's good practice to use them. So you would, in a given project, maybe have one, list definition that you just write in one particular place, and you reference that everywhere, and you say that your linked list conforms to that, and you write that in the class declaration. So then you would get conformance checking when you define the list. But the advantage here is now if you want to interoperate with some other code, they would just write out all the members of list, and you can interop just fine. It wouldn't have to be called the same type.
Yeah, I think the error problem, and generally, that the error problem is the compiler's view. The compiler is a tool sitting on top of these type systems, but I think it extends to things like hovering over a variable and seeing its type, right? And you want to have a simple name for what the type of something is. And I think that problem is something the structural systems can generally run into very easily. I think it is possible to create a structural type system where, as Donna was kind of saying, that there are names for structures that the user is able to provide into the system, and unless the developer is actually writing out complex structural types manually, those aren't going to get surfaced automatically. So all of the sort of type operations that are happening via constructs in the language are not. You want to avoid any operations in the language which cause arbitrary sort of combinations of structural types to happen, so that then you don't sort of make up complicated structural types. You're always reusing names.
But sometimes it's not always clear which names to pick, because there could be several names and abbreviations in scope. But there's things you could do. Maybe you could guess several different instances, and if you're hovering over, maybe there would be an error, and you could say, oh wait, no, that one doesn't quite make sense. But
I think there are tooling solutions to those kinds of things which can alleviate that problem. But I think along those lines, when you were talking earlier about some of the problems with structural type systems, the performance problems potentially for runtime checking of overloads or whatever. I think you know, this came up in the one of the sessions earlier today, that this question of basically, you know, what is the role of type systems, right, and what value are they providing? And I think this idea that a key role that type systems can provide is to support tools. You know, we talked earlier about how, like, there's lots of tooling we can provide over dynamic languages as well, and I think there's going to continue to be a lot more richness there. But we know that there's a set of tools that you know, static information can help, and so I think it'll be interesting to see how that can, you know, static structural type systems can be a foundation for that.
And to go back to kind of, you know, type-based overloading, sometimes I think the only reason that's there, and it's not only on Arity, is for constructors, because, you know, for normal math, I can always kind of invent another name,
right,
if I have like a class. But with a constructor, I cannot name my constructor.
Well, poorly designed languages for this feature.
Precisely.
Anyway. Languages that have this problematic.
Okay, so in Dart, can you name the constructor?
Yes. So in Dart, it essentially has no type-based overloading, because a cardinal principle is that types don't influence behavior. And the only place you might actually really need overloading in traditional languages is for constructors.
Yes.
But we constructors have several problems that Dart deals with. You can name them, and moreover, you can have factory constructors which don't actually have to return a new object of the class. They can return a cached object. They return an object of something different. You know, basically, they get around the abstraction failure of constructors.
Yes, because
can you override them?
No, you can't override them.
Okay, because I agree that constructors to me are the kind of, you know, it's like the kind of dirty little secret of many OO languages. They're kind of. They just stand out there.
Well, there is a better way, right, which is just to go with first-class classes and factory methods, as some languages do.
Or you can overload the new operator.
So I think the reason we're doing the constructor thing in Dart is because it's, again, familiar. So it looks like, especially if you write a simple program, it looks just like what people are used to, but it doesn't suffer from that set of problems that it does, right? On the other hand, insisting that everybody use, you know, pure methods is perhaps a bridge too far for some people, right?
But now when I say new button and you gave me a cached button, I would be kind of, you know, I would feel insulted, you know?
Maybe you would, but I would be happy with that button.
You would be happy with the second-hand button if you asked for a new one?
If it was just as good, I couldn't tell the difference. That's the whole point, right? I shouldn't be able to tell the difference between the new button and the cached button.
Well, do you have get hash code in Dart?
So the button business the button business has come up, and some people, you know, complain. But overall, yes, we think that that's really none of your business. And for you, you get an extra use button. We have this. You can write a factory constructor that tests, you know,
where the letters are kind of worn out.
You know, check, give return, very old button.
But it's like a thread pool, right? No one complains that it was a thread that was used before. It's not a new thread. I want my own thread.
But that's another interesting thing, is why do we need thread pools? Because, why don't we have button pools or string pools or
you can define your own, right?
Yes, but shouldn't we, the garbage collector, just take care of all this?
Well, because if you have a specific user-defined type, you may know how you want to cache things. Like, a very simple example is, let's say you want like integers, you want to have constant integers like Java has, and I don't think they by default hash cons everything, like from integers from like 1 to 100, but that would make sense because maybe they're very commonly used, but you know, maybe some very uncommonly used one you don't want to keep around. So I think it maybe depends, but maybe it would be useful, like some kind of LRU cache or something like that.
And so you could do that with Dart under the covers. Your new thing could keep a pool of buttons,
then you can do that. That's one thing you can do. You can choose to return a new button, and you can still have different names for the constructor. But you don't have to. And as for thread pools, yes, of course you shouldn't have thread pools, because you shouldn't have threads, right?
We're talking about the olden times.
Look at JavaScript. There's no threads in JavaScript. That's the new
times.
There's
one thread, isn't there?
Yes. There's one thread. There has to be one thread, or else you're not going to get much done.
Exactly.
but now, you know, it's interesting. Even the web platform has introduced concurrency through web workers, but not with a threading model, with a sort of actor model instead. And I think there's lots of interesting trade-offs, but it does mean that a lot of the sort of typical problems that you run into as a C# or Java developer are not problems that
I want to kind of, you know, throw an exception here, an asynchronous exception, because I never understood that argument, because in JavaScript, I have the timer kind of callback.
Sure.
And I have global variables.
Yeah.
So I can get exactly the same, because in C#, if I have a single core, there's no real concurrency, so my threads are scheduled, you know. And so I can schedule my own threads in the timer, and they can mutate global states. So you
absolutely
get exactly the same problems already in JavaScript.
Why do you keep saying
that you don't get the problems with threads?
Because
if you use C# in a mode where you do single threaded, but you have your scheduler run, you know, and queue all your work onto a single thread, yeah, you avoid all the same problems. But I think
I'm not saying that you avoid, but in JavaScript I can run into the same problems when I schedule stuff on the timer. They each call getbacks can mutate global states, so I get the same effects.
But you have sort of sections of code where you can reason, you know, the whole my method body. I can reason consistently about the behavior, any local variables I have, any global state I touch.
But you don't know whether this thing was changed.
But it gives you very discrete points where you have to reason about, like, okay, the entire state of the world.
I can do a lock, you know, across my kind of whole method.
And that's one of the tools that is used in C# to manage. This is just one global lock, just like in JavaScript. And I think if you do that, then you know that is a way in C# of trying to maintain your sanity, right? Is to just like, I'm going to stick a lock around everything because I do not want to try to figure out how to reason about like the granular, like during my algorithm, like at every step I have to reason about, even in the middle of an expression, I have to worry about like whether the state has changed between the +++ and the, you know, and the read of that variable, right? And so I think there is a big win in getting to a point where you can reason from the beginning to the end of your turn. You can reason about the consistent state of the system. I think that's a huge. And in practice, you see that the kind of concurrency concerns that when you go onto Stack Overflow and you look at what C# and Java developers are worrying about in terms of concurrency, it's a much wider and much more complex set of concerns than JavaScript developers dealing with a ton of async event-driven programming on the UI thread. Are not dealing with nearly as many of those kind of problems. There are still some problems, absolutely, because asynchronous event-driven programming is, there's a lot of state you have to be thinking about, a lot of transitions that could be happening. But I think just empirically, there's a much smaller set of issues that they're running into there, and it is just there's just fewer places they have to be thinking about these kind of problems.
Okay, that makes sense. So what does Dart do for concurrency then?
So Dart has a shared nothing model of concurrency. Mm-hmm. So we have these things called isolates, which in some implementations are in fact mapped to web workers. And in other implementations, there's a bit more freedom as to how to get this to happen. But basically, it's a very actor-like thing. These things communicate only by message passing. And so there's no shared state between these things ever.
And so can I have timers with callbacks that capture states from their context? And
you can't pass them across, right, these boundaries.
Okay, but within an isolate, you can still have global state.
You can certainly have global state in your isolate, right? You can have essentially the static variables of a library. They're global. Everything that's called static is per isolate, really. So they're sort of thread local statics, which is not perfect, right? But it's a lot better, as Luke said, than having the total mess that you have in traditional languages.
Yeah. So in .NET, you guys probably know, but there's a notion of app domain, which is very similar to an isolate. It's like your static variables are in the app domain, and it only kind of can communicate via message passing or sending delegates across. So
but there isn't a dedicated event loop per app domain. Right, I think was what I understand the isolate.
Well, it's an actor, right? You can send messages. So obviously, yes, there is something that is collecting those and activating things in some order, right? So it's very much like it's your very basic actor model. Of course, it's not functional or anything. I mean, Carl isn't here, so we can speak loosely of actors, but it is shared nothing. And pure message passing, which is the main thing.
And so when you send a message to an isolate, is that non-blocking then?
So there is this business of the implementing this on top of JavaScript, right? In principle, yeah, they're asynchronous. right? Now, how we actually manage that to work, yeah, so web workers can help here, but in the, from your perspective, you consider it's an asynchronous call.
So talking about asynchrony, so F-sharp was like a language that kind of, you know, pioneered, you know, the asynchronous whatever computation expressions.
Right.
And never kind of, you know, they have like so many kind of different expressions, query expressions, but definitely the kind of, you know, the computation expressions. So does F-sharp, will F-sharp, maybe you can explain those, and then the next question is, does F-sharp also implement the kind of, you know, the new task-based asynchronous model?
Oh, well, to answer that second part, we don't implement the task-based asynchronous model. We just have the model that we have had previously. So, I mean, it's compatible, but it's not exactly the same implementation as on the .NET TPL. But what you're describing is computation expressions, where basically imagine that you could write a block, and then you could say within this block that's denoted by some kind of identifier, you have your own keywords, and you know, it could be anything. Like, so in the query computation expression, you can say query, and then inside of that write select and from and things like that. And those are kind of, they look like keywords, and they're syntax highlighted in the IDE like they were keywords. And you know, you can think about it like you're adding your syntax, but really it's translated into method calls that you said what they were should be.
But aren't you then kind of basically overloading now keywords of the language?
Oh no, because so. Those would be things that aren't keywords in the language. So, you know, from, for instance, and select are not keywords. So it's basically like you could create your own keywords, but restrict it to some particular block. And that means that then if you want to basically create a new language feature, you'd only have to write a library to do that. You don't have to actually go and change the parser and the IDE and all those things. You just write it and that's done. So you could think of it as a very elegant way to consume a library, but from the user's perspective, it's actually defining a whole new abstraction.
And so now back to the JavaScript and Dart. So one of the things, like, you know, I think I find very powerful in C sharp and, you know, in F sharp to a certain extent, is that there's very advanced control flow mechanisms. For example, to kind of, you know, to have generators or the kind of awaiters. And so I must say I was a little bit disappointed when Dart came out that, you know, it only had like the old kind of, you know, control flow from the 1950s, you know, while loops and conditionals. No go-to,
we don't,
I think.
Have but computed, you know, go-to.
Yes,
though.
So, but, but
in fact, it's one of the few features I don't think anyone has asked for.
Okay, here.
But okay, so the idea for the async stuff in Dart was to put in the basic building blocks, the real underlying plumbing of async method calls and returning futures, and not to set any policy at a higher level yet till we have more time to experiment, to try it out. One of the things we have looked at is sort of await in a style that's not all that different from C sharp. It is a bit different because it's dynamically typed, so you know, some things don't, you know, no, don't, won't necessarily work the same way. We haven't made any decision on that. Promise pipelining. So at some point we will probably introduce a higher level of abstraction to make that easier and more pleasant. There's an ongoing debate over how many sort of synchronous wrappers to introduce or things like that, to which isn't resolved either. There's still you know, but the basic plumbing of underneath all these things is the same, and that's what's essential to support right now.
And so in JavaScript, like, you know, because there is also in some ways a lot of like both iterators and the await are variations of continuations, and for a while people were talking about adding, you know, continuations or exposing continuations to JavaScript because the continuations are already there, but we just don't surface them.
Yeah, I think I think that exposing continuations directly has not been where the committee has generally been at recently. I think for ECMAScript 6, iterators and generators are planned features and have some precedent that in Mozilla's browser they have some of this stuff implemented, and I think those can be, just like they are in C sharp and in .NET, those features can be useful for a bunch of collections kind of processing use cases. They can also be a foundation for sort of a more rudimentary approach to to asynchronous programming, and there's a few libraries out there already that show how you can use iterator concepts for
500 times reinvented also in .NET.
Exactly. And I think, you know, as we saw in .NET, those kind of approaches can potentially sort of move things forward, but they don't tend to feel as completely natural. Mm-hmm. Some of the syntax doesn't quite work out as well in things, and so the what became the C# await feature can still be a very useful addition on top of that. And there has been some discussion in the TC39 committee about an await style feature. And I think the general feeling when it's come up has been that it's a little too early to do, and I think we're going to look for people to experiment around that a bit beforehand. But you are seeing that a lot of libraries and a lot of tools that are doing a lot of asynchronous programming are sitting on top of a future/promise style API, and there's a few sort of common JS is sort of standardizing some patterns that a lot of libraries are following. Even in our Windows libraries for JavaScript, we sat on top of the common JS promise pattern. And that means, you know, those things, because of duck typing, those things are all interoperable. You can sort of consume one of those promises, return one of those promises. And since a lot of libraries are now sitting on top of those, you can imagine sitting a syntax that sort of allows you to coordinate across those as being a really nice value add on top of the language. And so I think that's something for the future. But it's certainly the case that, you know, to the extent that await is useful in C#, it's at least as useful in JavaScript, where, you know, so much of your code is sitting in, you know, sitting in the UI, sitting close to a bunch of sort of callback-based operations, doing you know, I/O against the network requests. It's sitting in a layer where there's just a ton of this single-threaded asynchronous code, and there's just a huge win for having a feature like C# await available there.
So I want to ask one last question, because we talked a lot about like the client, you know, like, you know, the browser and UI. But one of the things that's now happening is that JavaScript is moving to the server, and I guess that you also, like, you know, Dart, one of the, you know, intended uses is on the server. Whereas the other funny thing is that, you know, a lot of the kind of, you know, other languages are moving to the client. And I think it's because people probably just want to have one language to write, you know, both client and server code. So is there anything kind of, you know, well, maybe I will not make an open-ended question, but I will ask this. Like, one of the things that I often find that I want to do on the server side is that I need to have continuations that survive multiple requests, multiple HTTP requests. For example, you know, there's like a Twilio, it's like a telephony kind of, you know, web service, and there you have to kind of have a callback. It's like an event handler that you give to the service, that the service will call you back, you know, when you get a phone call. And there I want to kind of, you know, continue where I was kind of, you know, stopped. I want to kind of have an await, but that await can be, you know, can be maybe multiple days or for a long time. So is that something where, you know, as you say, Eric, you're, you know, did you get a package from Amsterdam or whatever, or like, you know, was there kind of, you know, mold on the cake, or
weren't they doing something like that with Flapjacks, the Ajax kind of Ajax based JavaScript like programming language?
I think that was in the browser, but these guys did something with continuations, yes,
right,
where they kind of, you know, would kind of, you know, do the server side.
So Eric, how's that different than WebSockets? I mean, what exactly are
it's
you
not,
trying
it's not
to
web
achieve?
So the thing is, what I want to do is I want to have an await.
Okay.
On the server side.
Okay.
But now on the server side, usually your program is stateless. Mm-hmm. So by the time, you know, you have sent your response back to the client, your thing disappears. But now when I get the next request, I want to kind of continue where I left off. So I want to do stateful.
Right. So basically you want to write sequential
stateful
code.
Server.
I want to write just like I want to with await, I can write sequential code that kind of, you know, awaits something.
I see.
So you don't want the inversion of control, basically.
Yes, and definitely on the server side. So I want to have stateful programming on the server side.
You can do that with await.
Well, you're waiting.
But my program will not persist, kind of, you know, across like, you know, machine failures,
sure,
or,
yes,
or multiple requests.
Yeah.
And WebSockets have, in some sense, a similar problem, because if I have a whole bunch of things that are subscribed to my WebSocket and my server goes down, I want the server to come up with, you know, all the WebSockets kind of, you know, reinstantiated and, you know, in the right state.
Interesting.
Write it in Smalltalk. Probably with an image and stuff. You might find it.
Yes. Yes. So it's like I want to do a core dump. It's like I tried to implement actually this on Unix a long time ago. You do a core dump, and then I want to kind of reload the core and kind of, you know, continue right there. Yeah. So that would be my ideal, like core dump as
well,
a language
feature.
Well,
why shouldn't we just make our servers fault tolerant, and then we wouldn't have this problem?
That's another thing. But I think the real problem is that we keep telling developers that they should write stateless server-side code, but I think that's really shoveling the problems under the carpet because, you know, if you really want to do cloud computing, you want to have the same kind of functionality on the client. This has to be symmetrical, and that means that the server-side code has to be stateful as well.
Does that impact scalability, though?
Well, but that's why we kind of, you know, have smart people to kind of, you know, to solve that, because otherwise, if you make it stateless, it has to be stateful anyway. So now every programmer is solving this by themselves. It's much better if the kind of, you know, if the server-side framework solves it for you, I think, but I don't know if that's maybe is that a bridge too far, Gilad?
I think it's an interesting thing. Like I said, you'd probably find it relatively easy to do it with a server processor with a small block image that saved itself at the right points and stuff like that, with C-side maybe. But generally speaking, for most people, that is a bridge too far.
But doesn't Dart have something where you can kind of, you know, snapshot an image?
So there is a snapshotting mechanism that's under development. It's mainly intended for fast startup, right? You know, we don't necessarily want to get into all the issues that Smalltalk images might bring, at least not at this stage, but
may
hopefully.
I request that? As a
please file a bug, file an issue. And
you'll close it?
No, we won't close it. We'll put it on the list along with computed go-to and other
really
high priority items. Yeah.
No, I mean, really, that is an interesting scenario. That's not where the focus for snapshots has been. It's been basically rapid startup, right? Because that's a huge problem with web programs, because you bring over the entire universe in order to because there's no standard platform beyond the DOM that you can rely on. And that stuff has to be parsed because there's no binary or intermediate form. And so for when you get to a really large program, it starts to be noticeable.
And so all I'm asking for is I want to have that same functionality on the server side, because it's
well,
also
the
I'm
snapshot
starting.
Will certainly be on the server side. The question is, what will you do with it? You know, maybe you can bend it to your will, right?
Maybe
it's an
I should start
thing.
Hacking on it. Yeah.
Absolutely, you should. But it hasn't been the focus of that thing, right? Its main purpose in this case has been, you know, how can I start up? Essentially, how can I start up my server quickly with, you know, this stuff that you wanted to save from in case of crash or whatever? Sure, you might be able to use that.
Yeah. So, any last words from Luke?
Just following up on that. I don't think it's. I don't think it's necessarily a bridge too far necessarily. The idea you're talking about is a nice ideal, but I do suspect that there's several steps along that way that are yet to be fully paved, and you know, look at the state of the art today, it's nowhere near there.
Exactly.
Right? I think it's going to be incremental steps that are needed to get.
And the sad
direction.
Thing is, I mean, I've been chasing this from 1997, so it's like, you know, it's time to kind of, maybe I should kind of step up and kind of solve
it. Yeah,
do it, Eric.
Yes,
you already will, remember V?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Just don't do it with core files.
Remember V?
Yes, I remember V. That was a try.
It was an interesting try. Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for doing this.
Yes, all right.
And we'll see you all again in another episode really soon.
All right.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you. Thanks.